Ladies and gentlemen, welcome all to yet another session of the Southern Border Council on Public Affairs. I'm your moderator today. My name is Klaus Jericho, and I'm taking the place of Cheryl Bradley, who's sitting right there. Cheryl asked me to do the administrator's duties for this function because she was gallivanting around in Finland with the Laplanders, and she just came back recently. And she had a wonderful time there, so I'm very pleased to see her back in one piece because we dearly need her in Lethbridge. I remind you, of course, for the $8 for your contribution to the meal and the facilities and the speaker. We welcome the viewers on Shaw Cable to join us. And we have lucky to have the speaker, Jason Unger, from the Environmental Law Center here with us today. Jason will speak about land use and the part you and I can play in it. It's a rather important subject matter because we impinge on land all the time. Jason is a lawyer by training from Dalhousie University. He practiced law at Calgary and Edmonton, and of late he has become a member of the Environmental Law Center, which I hope he will give us a little explanation of. And he specializes in forest law, in water law, and land use law. So if I can ask Jason to come up and tell us all about how we can take part in land use management. Please, Jason.
Thank you, Klaus. It's a pleasure to be here. As you mentioned, I'm talking about participation in the public, the land use planning process. The Environmental Law Center, where I work, we're a group of four lawyers who, the mission of the Environmental Law Center is basically to see that laws are protective of the environment and to promote effective participation in those laws as well. Now, the center itself, as I mentioned, we have four lawyers who respond to requests for information from individuals or from municipalities, industry, whoever calls the center. And it's a charity, so it's a free service to all Albertans. We have a 1-800 number as well that I could hand out later with a card. Besides answering questions from the general public, we go out into the community and talk to watershed groups or other community groups, industry associations, anyone who basically has interest in environmental and natural resources law and policy. We also do law reform initiatives where we monitor and comment on laws as they stand now and recommend possible changes to make them more protective of the environment. And we do a lot of legal research. As one might imagine, we have quite a big library in Edmonton where people can borrow any of the items free of charge as well, and we create publications, one of which I'll mention later today. So to jump right into the topic for today, participation in the land use planning process. As an introduction, I'll state some things that are somewhat obvious. Land and the resources in them are finite. And of course, some are, like oil and gas, are certainly finite and not typically sustainable in that you cannot regrow them or that type of thing. So it must be recognized in Alberta, as with elsewhere, the land base we're thriving on right now is finite. Property rights and values are deeply entrenched. From the evolution of, well, from the start of property rights being legally entrenched, we've garnered this philosophy of a lot of rights being associated with property and how we can treat our property. Also, Alberta's population continues to increase drastically, as does development. As I likely don't have to say to anyone here, there's increased pressures all over the place. And this, in turn, results in a lot of conflicts on land use. So the question that kind of comes to mind when I think of land use planning and the rights issues surrounding that is that when we say we don't want a particular land use in our backyard. What does that mean, and how can we affect that decision? In terms of the conflicts we see now on the landscape, there's a variety of them. Agriculture is in conflict with energy often enough. Examples of this are the recent coal bed methane developments that take up agricultural land. Some parties want the lease rent, the rental monies, while others would prefer to have the contiguous land base to farm property on. An extreme example of an agricultural oil and gas issue as well is with the Weibo-Ludwig case further north. Urban areas and energy are also coming at odds. Just outside of Calgary, Compton, with their sour gas wells proposals, there was a lot of discussion and a hearing took place regarding that and the safety of sour oil and gas or sour gas near residences is also a big issue. Recreation and logging, the conflicts spill over onto public lands in terms of access to public lands, recreation on public land, and how we deal with those issues. And of course, on a more municipal level, there's the issue of urban expansion or urban sprawl and eating up agricultural lands that we've seen, usually prime agricultural lands in Alberta that are being eaten up by country residential homes or residential and urban expansion. And then, not thought of as a typical land use, but certainly watershed values and wilderness values are in conflict with a lot of human development generally. So there's certainly not a lack of conflict in Alberta when it comes to land use. And one could argue, and I hope there's a good debate later on, whether public participation is part of the answer to resolving those conflicts. So through participation, I would argue that we can create awareness in decision makers and the broader public. We can ensure that decisions are at least somewhat accountable because we know our voice has been heard. For the purpose of today's talk, I'll separate participation in land use into two separate areas. One, municipal land use planning, and the second, basically where municipal land use or municipal governments don't have a lot of say in that land use. Under municipal land use planning, which is governed by the Municipal Government Act in Alberta, there's several tools, planning tools that a municipality uses, including the municipal development plan, area structure plans, land use bylaws, zoning bylaws, often associated with the land use bylaws, and then right down to subdivisions and development permits. And we'll just touch on each of those and talk about how one can participate in those processes. And then we'll go on to talk about the non-municipal land uses that I was referring to. Municipal development plans are very general in nature. They're very overbroad, long-term planning ideas. They kind of will set out protection of agricultural areas, ideas for transportation, long-term growth strategies. But typically they're more of a visioning document. They aren't very prescriptive. They don't tell you exactly what's going to happen on the landscape. Public participation in the municipal development plan is important because of that visioning capacity in the plan. Now, under the Municipal Government Act, there are no requirements for a municipality to review their municipal development plan. So often it's up to people to get council to take that initiative to review that plan. Typically, there's open houses and meetings, public meetings, wherein the municipality will gather information from the public in developing that plan, and that's a good area to put in vision statements like having our community go ahead with smart growth, which is kind of a buzzword these days in terms of how we develop our communities. Area structure plans are much more heavily engineered documents compared to the municipal development plans. Area structure plans are typically produced by developers in conjunction with municipal planners. Basically, they target proposed land uses, population densities, transportation and utility corridors, and they really are a bit more prescriptive in terms of what land uses are going to take place in a certain area. Again, municipalities have to hold a formal hearing prior to approval of these area structure plans, and that can be a good area where public participation takes place. I would argue, however, that to effectively participate, that you should participate earlier in the process in the preparation of those plans, if at all possible, because that the engineering that's gone into these plans, there's been a lot of money spent by the developers. If you go in at the last step and say, well, we should protect this watershed feature or we should do this, they'll be like, well, we've spent all this money. What are we going to, we're not going to go and change that now. And council would be hard pressed to take that position, although they could. Other structural plans, which I won't really discuss, include area redevelopment plans, wherein there's plans for redeveloping an area, typically communities or in urban or urban areas where they want to see a new face on a neighborhood. They can go through an area redevelopment plan. There's also more geographically limited plans in neighborhood structure plans. But then if we go on to the land use bylaws, we see a bylaw that really is prescriptive and detailed. And this is really where the bylaw itself governs how land will be subdivided, if it will be subdivided at all, what the uses will be on the land, and the municipalities have wide-ranging powers in terms of what they can prescribe in a land use bylaw, including building design. So if there's low-impact building designs that a municipality wants to promote, they can do that through a land use bylaw as well. Once again, the land use bylaw is open to public participation prior to its approval. Beyond that, anyone who is a resident, I checked in the Lethbridge land use bylaw, and typically the ability to amend a land use bylaw is in the bylaw itself, and the Lethbridge land use bylaw says that any resident can apply to amend the land use bylaw. So that's an important tool in terms of public participation. Typically it's used to develop land, but there's nothing in the Municipal Government Act or the land use bylaw to prohibit one taking those steps to perhaps pursue smart growth or protect certain features of your land. Now, under the Municipal Government Act, there are also certain requirements, because they are statutorily mandated plans, there's certain requirements that municipalities must see through in terms of incorporating public participation. In this regard, a municipality must provide a means for any person who may be affected by the plan to make suggestions and representations. And the question might arise, who is a person affected? And perhaps we'll talk about that a bit later. And they also must notify the public of plan preparation process and the means of making suggestions and representations to the municipality. To basically sum up on the municipal front, the area structure planning and municipal development planning processes are very important as they guide development in your community. If you can set up and have the proper vision statements leading to proper zoning of different areas, I think the public participation aspect of that will govern development in such a way that you can protect features of your community that you find to be important, whether that be social issues or environmental issues or economic issues. In terms of subdivision and development permits, there's a much more limited ability to participate in those processes. Typically, it's adjacent landowners or directly affected parties who can have a say or may appeal certain development permits in certain instances. It's important to recognize, however, by that point in the process, it's so detailed and it's typically within the land use bylaw already. It's in compliance with it, I should say. So both the subdivision authority or the development authority have limited ability to refuse a properly forwarded application. Next, I'd just briefly like to talk about recognizing where municipalities don't have a lot of power in terms of determining land use within their municipality. And this primarily targets areas where administrative bodies in the province, primarily the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board and the Natural Resources Conservation Board, have administrative powers and jurisdiction. For these two boards, once they've made a decision, municipalities have very little say in terms of whether that development goes ahead, whether that land use occurs. So energy developments, wind energy or oil and gas developments, confined feedlot operations, recreational developments, a whole mess of developments where the jurisdiction falls to these administrative boards, there's little that a municipality can say. So then the question is, how do you participate in those decisions? Unfortunately, there's a more limited planning process, more of a consultation with affected landowners. And basically, if a development is going in your backyard, there are certain legislative requirements to consult with the landowner who might be affected by that land use. On a broader scale, however, beyond policy initiatives that the government has, there's limited legal rights in terms of participating in an actual planning process. Part of the difficulty in this, particularly with oil and gas development, is that the minerals themselves are sold to companies without any public participation whatsoever. So there's a right given to these companies to develop the minerals prior to any input being gathered from a community. Also, the Municipal Government Act basically dictates that municipalities have to approve developments of those types of industries once they come down the tube to the municipality to develop them. There is an appeal process there, but I won't get into that for purposes of today's talk. As I mentioned, also the EUB and the, I'll use the acronyms, the Energy and Utilities Board, the EUB, or the NRCB, the Natural Resources Conservation Board, typically, very rarely, will they refuse development. Often, they'll sometimes, or often, put conditions on these developments. However, it's rare. Like, it counts on one hand how many times the EUB has refused a well license, for instance. If we go then to look at public land use planning, so previously I was talking about both public and private land uses, and both private and public land. If we go then to public land use planning, the ability to participate is further restricted, primarily because of that idea that one has to be affected to be consulted. And that's basically limited because you need a substantive legal right in the land. So if you're a leaseholder on public land or you happen to have a trap line perhaps, then you might have the ability to participate in those land use planning processes. Otherwise, you have to rely on more policy initiatives of the government. Certain policy opportunities that exist are participating in recreational access management plans or forest management plans. So a lot of different planning processes do exist, but those are more of a policy nature. And being a lawyer, I seem to always rely on the legal rights you can take to court and flash in front of somebody's head and say, I have this right, but let me be heard. If we look then on as a continuum, we have broad broad rights to participate in municipal plans, those become more limited once we get to more resource-based activities. And then even more so once we move to the public land area, where public participation rights are quite limited indeed. And to get down to the bottom of why these conflicts occur and why the difficulties we have in land use planning exist, I would say that it really comes down to an issue of rights and an issue of how we exercise those rights in terms of each other, in terms of corporations. Do we want unhindered rights to exploit property? Do we want a free-for-all? Or do we want restrictions on those rights? We already limit some rights in terms of property use. We can't dump toxic substances on our land. We can't even let noxious weeds grow on our land. And those regulations are there for good reasons, and it's a question of how far we want to take that. Examples of how contentious it can be are all around Canada, generally. If one looks at Ontario and the Oak Ridges Moraine, which is a greenbelt area that was designated, there was a lot of contention between the developers and conservation people who were really at odds. And the developer has a strong heart, a big stick. He's saying, I own the property. You can't say I can't develop it there. And that's a big investment for a developer to all of a sudden be turned around and said, well, the community doesn't want you to develop there, so you're out of luck. But at the same time, there's got to be a balance to these rights. In BC, they have agricultural land reserves. So basically, they have a designation for agricultural land that prohibits non-farm use, and it also prohibits subdivision. Now, they can apply basically to a commission to allow for subdivision and non-farm uses, but there's a separate process set up for that. And if we take it even more a step down then, in terms of conflicts of land use, I would suggest that it's this rights issue that really we have to deal with. The Crown rights to minerals, so the Crown owns the rights to underneath the surface, while the property owner owns the rights to the surface. Agricultural rights to farm in a traditional manner versus personal rights if a nuisance is created. Public rights on public lands versus industrial rights to manage public lands and to take those resources out of public lands. Private rights to subdivide, and this is a big one, versus public interest in maintaining agricultural or mixed-use areas or environmentally sensitive areas, despite private ownership. These rights issues are central in a democracy. Do we want good land use planning? Do we want unhindered property rights? Sometimes the two are diametrically opposed. Land use planning is a balancing act, and it's not an easy one at that. So if I'll just touch on some barriers and opportunities I see in terms of creating communities, sustainable communities, I would argue. Public participation in resource uses is quite limited, particularly for public land. Municipalities have somewhat limited powers under the Municipal Government Act to affect a broad range and to govern how their community actually evolves. So while they do have a lot of powers under the planning and zoning provisions, those powers are somewhat cut off once it hits certain resource uses. Municipalities often also lack the financial capacity to deal with all the multitude of issues coming at them. And often the point of public participation is very late in the process. It's after a lot of work and a lot of money has been spent. So getting in early is a key. And also on a more philosophical level, land use rights and restrictions on those rights are not generally accepted by private landowners. That's a very big generalization, but at the same time, it's inherent in how we view property. Opportunities I see bring planning to the table early through principles and vision statements in the municipal development plans, the area structure plans. So getting involved in municipalities and their planning process is a very important part of that. There's recent moves from the provincial government to integrate land use planning and integrate land resource extraction through what they typically call integrated land use management, trying to minimize the cumulative effects of resource extraction. And then there's also policy initiatives such as the Water for Life strategy, which can be expanded to a watershed level and kind of govern areas where it's beyond the mere scope of a municipality's powers, and it incorporates broad stakeholder input in that regard. And really, it's about making sure people are informed and being aware of everybody's positions to make good decisions. To conclude, laws and policies exist to allow for public participation in land use planning. Depending on the nature of the land use, the inclusiveness of this participation process varies greatly. Municipal land use issues are guided by municipal development plans, area structure plans, and can incorporate a wide variety of public input. Participation in resource-intensive land uses is more limited. The question that you're asked then is, do you have an economic or property interest in this decision-making and planning process? Is participation an exercise in futility, some might ask? We often get calls at the Environmental Law Center about how to stop a development. Like, this proposal has come up, how do I stop it? And basically the straight answer is, usually, you can't. But you can change how things are planned, you can possibly change how the development takes place, and it's building that awareness and participating in the framing of plans and planning policy that you contribute to the dialogue that decision makers have. And that's really the key to better planning and reducing conflict on the land base. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason, for this quick journey of how we manage our land. It's rather scary, isn't it? The responsibility imposed upon all of us and the restrictions. I invite you now to enjoy our lunch, and we will come back in 30 minutes for discussion.